somebody, I forget his name, he asked me to do something for money. And he said he'd give me $100. And I, you know, started a PayPal. And I still remember this day looking at PayPal and seeing $100 in there for customizing that, doing something I wanted for once in life and getting paid for it was like probably one of the best moments I ever had. So that set a fire, like a nuclear explosion under my ass. And I was just like, I can do this.
Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast, your weekly dose of knife news and information about knives and knife collecting. Here's your hosts, Jim Person and Bob the Knife Junkie DeMarco.
Hello, Knife Junkies, and welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast, episode number 30. I'm Jim Person.
And I'm Bob, the Knife Junkie DeMarco. Welcome to the show.
We have an interesting interview on this show, but first, I do want to remind you that our podcast, the Knife Junkie Podcast, is brought to you by Audible. If you love audio like Bob and I do, you can get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial just by going to audibletrial.com/knifejunkie. There's over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Again, audibletrial.com/knifejunkie. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial. Just our way of saying thanks for listening to the Knife Junkie Podcast. And Bob, another knife designer, knife maker, if you will, but really a knife artist that you're going to be having a chance to talk to on this show.
Yeah. In my opinion, he really is. Jeff Blauvelt. You ever have a song, Jim, something by Led Zeppelin maybe, that you're like, man, I wish I wrote that song. Or if I were, a rock and roll songwriter, I would have written that song. Well, when I look at his knives, that's how I feel. They're beautiful. They're art. They're functional art, of course. But something about him really resonates with me, and he's very prolific. I mean, every day it seems like there's a new masterpiece coming out on Instagram.
Right. Right.
So I just had to get him on and talk to him.
Well, and I do want to let our listeners know that we would have had Jeff on, a month or more ago. In fact, we thought we did. We had you had a great conversation with him, but as you said in the newsletter this past week, a glitch, some kind of technical something, the audio quality just came out so bad. It was unfortunate because it was a great conversation, but I think this is going to be a great conversation. I just have no doubt.
Yeah, I think we redeemed it. Yeah, for sure.
You guys kind of just click, you know?
Yeah. I think there's a little bit of the Philly connection. There's a little bit of the art school connection, and his knives are just outstanding.
And that interview is coming up next right here on the Knife Junkie Podcast.
You're listening to the Knife Junkie Podcast. Call the Knife Junkie at 724-466-4487 with your questions or comments.
I wanted to congratulate you on the Switch model coming out, Custom Knife Factory.
Yeah, they're here. They got them for sale. I think they had like the first 20 or something, and then they said they sold out faster than any other model, which is pretty cool.
Than any other Custom Knife Factory model?
That's what they said, and everybody seems to like them.
So how do you feel about it as a representation of your custom Switch?
It's pretty freaking perfect. I mean, it definitely probably works better than one of mine because it's, made with multi-million dollar machines. And
right. And each time it's the same.
Yeah, it's very smooth and very nice. I have a couple questions about some things they chose, but for the most part, I couldn't be happier.
I know you do most of your designing not freehand, but you're a draftsman, you draw. Yeah. So how did you give them this design? Did you send them an actual example and they break it down from there, or did you learn CAD?
Well, usually I rely on, with my ArcForm stuff, I rely on a customer that's like a friend. I'll just be like, hey, can I take this and send it to Russia for a year? And usually they're like, yeah. So I took my buddy's model. They still have it for some odd reason. And they basically did that. I took a bunch of pictures of some edits I made to it because that one wasn't my favorite one out of all of them. Because I make each one separately. So even though they're the same, I do minor adjustments as I design the knife or make the knife. So, I sent them a really detailed picture of what I wanted changed on it, which was interesting how they did a perfect job of taking my pictures and actually applying to the model they had and changing it up. So yeah, that's what I try to do. I mean, most people send like a CAD file, but I have no idea how to use that. And I don't know how to do math or spell. Or read.
All of this makes me feel so good.
I don't know what a ruler is or what are those things? Calipers? Yeah. I've heard of them, but.
Yeah. Pencil and paper.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. And I use rocks to grind the knives and just bang on them. It takes a while.
Anyone who would do less is less than a man.
Exactly.
So how'd you get into making knives? I used to watch you on YouTube. You did a lot of knife modifications for people, and you did these epic long videos that were great, where you would sort of show off the most recent 12 knives you've tweaked.
Yeah, that was crazy.
I also pored over a two-part video you did about making Emerson scales, and I watched it for a while. I was like, I'm going to do that, and then after a while,
was that the like the really old video on how to make
really old? Like you're sitting on a cooler.
I've like updated the description of that. Like, do not follow this. This is BS, and it is totally wrong. Because I mean, that was like that was so long before I actually like that was before I had like a drill press. I mean, right, like yeah. It was, and I keep it up there just because I don't care. Like, you know what I mean? Like, all this stuff's up there on my YouTube channel. Some of it's the most cringy thing you'll ever see in your life, but I like it. You know what I mean? I don't mind. It's like, there's a growth there. If you watch all the videos, have like 2 years to spend watching videos of me,
it's your biographer. I mean, why get
it's my history. I mean, it literally is. I mean, it's really weird. And someday I'll go back and watch all of them if they don't get, you know, taken off of YouTube for having music in the background.
When your children force you to watch them.
Nah, my wife has never watched a single video. Really? I told her she couldn't. And she never did, actually. But, you know, like...
That's what she says.
Yeah. Anyway. I was a little shy about it. You know, I had to put music on in the background because the quiet was, like, too awkward for me. So right. I never made a dime off of a single YouTube video, except for, you know, launching my career, which is totally fine with me. So
it
paid for itself pretty much. So, you know, it's not like I was doing huge production or anything.
How did it happen that you went from an art student to someone who is, people were entrusting their $500 knives to tweak and to make cool, to someone who's making beautiful, and I hesitate to say art knives because they seem way more useful than just an art knife.
Yeah, it's a mixture between the two.
Yeah, yeah. So how did that evolution occur?
You know, I was an artist, air quotes. I always hated that label because the people around me like annoyed the hell out of me because artists are kind of douchebags for the most part. I never liked the art scene, I guess. Like, I had a couple galleries of my paintings, and I could not stand, like, these people around me. Like, people would draw a triangle on a piece of paper with, like, some rainbows on it, and, like, it was like, oh my god, this is, like, so-and-so, and he's, like, this great artist. He was homeless once. I'm like, congratulations, you can't draw or paint. But yeah, like, I just wanted to do something creative with my life, and art is a dead end. I mean, anybody who's into art, unless you're doing graphic design really well in that most saturated market on the planet, you're pretty much going to fail unless you're, you know, hit by lightning or something. So I kind of realized that, and I always liked actually making things more original, I guess, like taking something I own and, you know, customize like a skateboard. I used to paint on skateboards for a company. And I basically, you know, I was delivering pizza at the time, and I started carrying a knife. My first knife was a Smith & Wesson knockoff. And, you know, I liked carrying knives at that point. I never really did. I had, you know, Swiss Army knives for my grandpa, like when I was little, but never really cared much about them or thought of them as anything I needed really to live my life. But I started carrying like this crappy knife and I really liked it. It was a flipper. And I started kind of watching YouTube videos of like Cutlery Lover and Nuttin' Fancy. Mm-hmm. And they were awesome. Nuttin' Fancy actually shouted out my channel when the first like 2 months I had a YouTube channel, which made me basically crap my pants. And I mean, he was back in the day, he kind of got a little full of himself after time, you know, no offense, Nuttin' Fancy, but you know, you're like the most full of yourself guy out there, but you know, he's the grandfather of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I still watch his SHOT Show footage every year cause it's exciting, but I would look around the forums at knives. I started looking at blade forums and I saw customizing handles and stuff like that. And I decided to try that out after starting my collection. And the first one I messed with was a Spyderco Tenacious. I had the plain G10 scales and I thought they were pretty boring. And Yen Zanzo was the first custom maker I actually saw pictures of their knives. Or, you know, I was like, what the hell is that? And the Anzo pattern was so... I mean, it made my whole life like change when I saw it.
So describe the Anzo.
It's like basically like grooves coming in from both sides, meeting in the middle, like teeth, like alternating. And
this is on a handle scale.
On G10 handles, and like the G10 has a grain to it. And I found out later he would like sandblast the G10, which would bring out the grain more. Because you know, I was trying to figure out how to do that the way he does it. So it was just so clean, and like, you know, back then that was like the shit.
Yeah. And it feels really good when you grip it.
Yeah, exactly. So I wanted to do that. And I basically in my house, no mask, indoors, windows closed, with like a hand drill and like a
with the oven on and the door
exactly open. With yeah. Like a little rock bit for like sharpening like chains. I don't know. Right.
Yeah.
You know, I just did it. It was terrible, but like I want, you know, it looked good enough for me to be like, I want to do this. And then, the YouTube was, YouTube originally was just reviews of like production knives that I would buy, like cheap knives. And, I did the Tenacious. I don't even remember, but I think people were like, wow, that's cool. And, I got the idea to start doing YouTube videos of the customization by the fact that there was zero videos of that. And barely any pictures besides on specialized areas in the forums, like sub forums with pimped knives, I guess you call them at the time.
So you were searching for how to videos basically so you could accelerate your own skill and you weren't.
There definitely was no how to anything there as far as that goes. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of the guys that were modding knives back then, I mean, I'm not afraid to say it because none of them are around anymore. They were assholes. Like, maybe it's because they were the only ones doing it. But they did not want to give me the time of day, which is strange because any knife maker you talk to now, they will basically, you know, give you the shirt off their back. Like most makers are they just love to just talk to people and help them out. So it's different now, I guess. But, you know, knife modding, that whole community was terrible. I mean, they were so bad. I mean, it was a lot of people like just because it, you know, it was a really weird thing and not a lot of people did it. And we're kind of all sharing the same customers back then. So it was like,
and a couple of people disappeared if I remember correctly with property of others and
yes, that was, that was a thing, but not to jump ahead too much. I decided to try this out. I was unemployed because of the job I had as a scenic artist was like so off and on. And,
you mean in theater?
Like I did like the Please Touch Museum in Philadelphia. If you go there, there's a whole cityscape of Philadelphia, like a whole miniature Philadelphia. I did basically every brick on the wall was hand painted, all the trees and everything. I painted all that. So if you go there, that's a Tough Knives custom exhibit.
Brutal. Yeah,
I enjoyed it. You know what I mean? It was terrible pay, and the job, you know, the work was off and on. So it was just, I decided to try this out and I bought a Dremel and, I basically sat there in front of a fan with a Dremel and ordered some Jade G10 because I thought Jade was the coolest thing and started just messing around and showing videos and pictures of it. And somebody, I forget his name, he asked me to do something for money. And he said he'd give me $100 and I, you know, started a PayPal. And I still remember this day looking at PayPal and seeing $100 in there for customizing that, doing something I wanted for once in life and getting paid for it was like probably one of the best moments I ever had. So that set a fire like a nuclear explosion under my ass, and I was just like, I can do this. So skipping ahead, you know, I was doing them, and the Paramilitary 2 came out, and it was the most popular knife on the face of the earth, and nobody customized them because they had milled nested liners.
Yeah, what a pain! And also the lanyard hole is a pain in the ass to deal with.
Everything about that was a pain in the ass, but I agreed to try to do one, and I was in the shop from, I say, 9 a.m. to 4 a.m. No bullshit. And I was in it. You know, like I didn't talk to anybody the whole time. I don't think I ate either. But I did it all by hand. I milled out G10 scales by hand, which is ridiculous.
You mean like with a little chisel or something?
I think I had like an end mill that came with like a Dremel or something. It was like serrated on the bottom, but flat barrel, like quarter inch. And I think I just set the depth on the drill press into the scale, because there is a path you can go in on the paramilitaries, and I just kind of shaved it away slowly on a flat table, and it took forever, but it actually worked. And I ashamed of myself for this, but I did take money up front. But back in the day, there was no rules, really. I mean, it kind of.
So what is that rule? Tell me about that.
Taking money up front is basically they pay before you're done the work, which is the big problem that came up with the knife customization community. Was people would take money up front, and you think you could do something. You basically enter a contract, like guarantee it's going to be done at this point. You know what I mean? And you don't realize, being a small business owner just starting out, that like everything gets in the way. Like everything goes, like if someone says it'll take 2 weeks, it's going to take 3 months. You know what I mean? So that's what happened. And people would take way too many orders, and because it's so easy just to take an order. Yeah, I would get like 50, 60 emails a day, and people were willing to shell out the cash up front. And, you know, I kept up with it, luckily. But it was very easy to like destroy your business real fast with taking money up front. So it's kind of seen as like a pretty much a no-no now, or for years now.
Well, I have to admit, I back in 2008, I guess, or nine. I fell victim to being stupid, basically, and not doing my own due diligence. And I sent a knife maker who made this really cool tactical version of a Filipino blade. And I wanted a different Filipino blade because, you know, they have millions of them. And, you know, I asked him if he could make it. He's like, sure, I'm going to need this much. And what do you want me to make it out of? And, you know, I had this whole menu of materials and I was all swept up by that. And I picked out my knife and I sent him my money and I never heard back from him. And then I was constantly, you know, haunting blade forums and saw all these things about him. I was like, I'm such an idiot. I should have done my research.
Yeah. I mean, some of those guys, like when these guys would mess up like that, I understood it completely, man. I mean, it's a horrible thing that, like, that's why I would tell people not to do it. Like, when people said they wanted to start modifying knives for a living, I'd be like, if you do it, you have to have the most discipline that you could possibly have, because it is very, very easy to screw up and start getting overwhelmed with orders. And people deal with it in, like, a couple different ways. I dealt with it by just never doing anything but working and making sure that even though I was behind the ball here, I had to finish this stuff. So screw everything else. Yeah. I'm going to sit in the shop all day, every day until I get done. Other guys, they would just run and hide and disappear. And that happened a few times. And it's bizarre to me. But yeah, there's still guys that I used to talk to all the time that just vanished off the face of the earth because they took a bunch of money. Oh, yeah. Geez. And I know they didn't do it. And I know they didn't want to do that, but it just ended up that way. Yeah.
That's how
they get scared, you know?
Yep. Yep. Well, I knew that you had turned a corner just in casually watching your videos when you accepted someone's Strider and you took a regular drop point and turned it into a warm clip.
Oh, Terra Fanatic?
I don't remember if it was Terra Fanatic.
He put up a video on Instagram the other day, actually, because, you know, that was the first time I ever talked to him. Yeah, that was a bizarre thing. I mean, I saw the Strider warm clip. Like, basically, when you start off like that, what I was doing, you don't know that custom knives are actually, like, if you mess with a custom knife, it's like walking into an art exhibit and painting over someone's painting. You know what I mean? Yeah. I saw it as, oh, this guy bought a knife and he wants it to make it even more his own, you know? But, you know, I did like maybe three or four custom knives I actually modified and I regret them to this day. Mm. And I get shit for it still. And I understand it and I deserve it.
Good humored shit, I hope.
Some yes, some no. Some will hate me forever, but, you know, I apologize and, you know, did what I could. And I told them all, you know, any warranty work that goes on, it's now on me. So, you know what I mean? Like, I now am responsible for that knife by that maker. So, yeah, that's pretty much what he had to do. So, but yeah, you don't want to do that ever. But yeah, the modifying knives thing, it was dangerous, man. I mean, it's a lot of little amounts of money and a lot of work. Like, and I realized quickly when I started making knives that making a folder actually took less time than making custom scales in some cases.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, because replicating factory machines and making these, like, you have to be perfect. I mean, you have to do all the counterbores exactly the same as the machinery and Spyderco's factory. All these things have to be absolutely spot on.
So the screws don't go in too deep or whatever.
So instead of doing the same depth for your counterbores in every custom folder you're making, you have to change it every single time for every single model and have every single type of screw sitting around because you're going to break them because they're usually garbage screws on most knives. Right. And yeah, it was way too much work. I mean, I loved it, but you know, I could tell it was dangerous and there wasn't much of a future in it. So
how did you go from using a Dremel on factory G10 handle scales to actually grinding blades and creating your own?
Well, you know, common sense, you know. I mean, first it was like, I want to do this so I can buy more knives. I mean, that honestly is pretty much the goal of everybody who did that back then. But it was then I need to buy more equipment. And, you know, Harbor Freight is kind of like the Lord and Savior of most people starting out. I mean, they're great. I mean, you know, it's garbage, but at the same time, there's some gems in there. You know what I mean? The what was it? The 1x32 grinder, the green or 1x, well, I don't forget what it is. The little grinder. Everybody had that thing. Uh-huh. What was the question again? I forgot. Halfway through there, I forgot what I was saying.
Well, I was just wondering how you went from grinding factory handle scales and doing that to actually grinding blades, like not just blades, but very complicated looking, unique blades. I mean, I look at your Instagram feed all the time, and I mean, your knives have subtleties to them that you are able to repeat. And so that's part of your design language. Where did all that come from? Just from, you know, you're tweaking knives and now you're making these knives.
Well, I mean, John Gray was pretty much my knife father. He contacted me one day and I'd always wanted to try grinding a knife. I didn't have a grinder, of course, and they're expensive. You know, they could be like, you know, $1,000 to like $5,000, you know? So John got a hold of me, came over, and we hung out, and I, you know, I went to his house, and, you know, he had a grinder there. We tried it out, and, you know, skip a couple years later, and I'm living with the guy. And that's when I started to get out of the pimping knives and into making folders, because John was making fixed blades, and he was working on folders as a side project. And, you know, I planned my Tannic, and I made a couple handmade knives. Some of them I have still. But just from customizing knives, I knew the ins and outs of how a knife functioned, like especially a frame lock. I knew it so well that I could actually make one by hand without any mills or anything like that. So I got the idea how to do it, and basically went on from there. And we got a hold of a guy that did water jet. And so we started the Tannic project, or I started the Tannic project, and you know, invested a bunch of money into it. And the Tannics were pretty cool. I mean, they're big and bulky and crazy. But you know, they were a lot of fun, and the knife customization stuff came through in there. I'm sure you noticed every one of them was like a pimp job, you know, after I got the function down and everything like that. You know, it just turned into like fun and creativity, and that was really fun for me. And the grinds were terrible in the beginning, but the thing was that my philosophy with those Tannics were, you know, I was more into like fixed blades back then, and like splitting wood with like big choppers, yes, like Gavco. And we all agreed that the best grind was like a convex grind for choppers, mm-hmm, and everything like that. Like a very, very shallow, slight convex to your flat grind. Okay. So I wanted to apply that to a blade. So the Tannics all have a convex grind. I don't think people know that. So you could, you know, shove it in there and just start batoning a piece of wood, and it would go through it nicely, more than like, say, like a hollow ground knife I would make now or something like that. It would just stop. And, you know, those things were made to be beat to hell.
Thumped up. Yeah. You have a funny story about a customer that reached out to you about a story about his Tannic. Tell me that.
Yeah,
story.
That was this guy, he wanted a Tannic real bad, and I made like a real special one for him. It was all titanium with bricks carved into it, and some of the bricks were actually small pieces of titanium bolted onto it to give like a really crazy industrial look. And he was kind of a friend, and we kind of lost touch, but he has Tannic, he loved it. And one day he got in a car accident. And I guess his car flipped and went off a bridge or something into some water. And he told me that he woke up in the hospital, and the first thing he did was he looked at the doctor or whoever was next to him, was like, "Where's my Tannic?" And I was like, you're kidding me. He's like, "No, that's literally what I did." And then he went out there, I guess a couple days later, a few weeks later or something. He went out, and I was like, "Oh, I may as well try and find it." So he went into the river that is crashed in or whatever, and he found the Tannic, and it worked great. And he was super excited, and it was, you know, well, N690 steel, I think. So it's pretty rust proof. So, I got it back. I told him to send it back to me and make sure everything was good. And not even no rust on it, nothing. I mean, the thing was still working just fine.
That is not only a testament to a customer's love of your product, but also of your product itself, that it survived the river and the car.
Yeah, I do what I do. Like, I'm kind of a type of guy that like hates a model after I'm done with it. You know what I mean? I don't hate it, but like some of the older ones, I'm just like, ew. You know what I mean? Like, fool myself or put down the Tannic or anything like that. But there was a couple that were just terrible. And
You're an artist, and you came up through an art education, as far as I know. And I understand that you make a drawing, you make a painting. When you're done with it, it's done. You're done with it, unless you're going to live with it and decide how to make it perfect. So do you live with any of your knives? Do you ever carry anything that you make?
No. I used to. I used to make them once in a while. And I think the thing about having a kid was that was the thing I had to sacrifice. I mean, there's a lot of other things I had to sacrifice. But as far as my business goes, I no longer have the pleasure of being able to carry my own knife pretty much. Like I used to have them. I'd never keep them ever, really. I would keep them for like 2-3 months. I think the longest I had one that I carried was about a year maybe. And I eventually sold it, though, but I don't get to really carry them that often. I know they work great and everything, and, you know, I know my parts well enough to know that, you know, what's what. I don't need to carry it for a year to know.
Right. You're not in a constant testing thing. But just to have and to hold, no?
No, I mean, you know, if I suddenly came into like 10 grand out of nowhere, then I'd spend a couple days and make myself a knife, you know, so I could take a break. The thing, though. Every knife is a paycheck for me. So so it's basically like I'm going to take my paycheck from work and put it in a drawer or carry it in my pocket for the next couple of weeks. Like, you just can't do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But with the production models, it's pretty cool. Actually, get to carry those around.
So what's it What's it like working with these production companies? You just worked with Custom Knife Factory. You said that was kind of mysterious and cool, but you've worked with Arcform and Boker. And I know I'm missing some. I know you did small projects with like Elijah Isham.
Yeah. The collabs and the production stuff's a lot different.
So what's it like on these big production jobs?
I mean, the first one was Boker. I like it. I mean,
that was the ward. Friction folder.
It's nice. I mean, it's different, you know, it's less personal than a collaboration, of course, but it's, you know, it's kind of nice to have somebody, you know, to have the type of respect I have in the knife community that people will actually come to me and say, I'll make your model. And basically you do nothing and you get paid for it every few months. That's really nice. You know, that's kind of a goal. Like, you know, a lot of these guys put out a ton of different collabs, and it's for one, it's really fun to do because it's really cool to see them make your knife. That's like one of the coolest things ever. But also just collecting a paycheck, because it's a really nice bit of relief for most knife makers, I think, because, you know, it's, you might get $1,000 to $1,500 a knife, but you're spending, you know, 10 to 20 grand a month on supplies. You know, it's, you know, it's crazy.
Well, it's like getting a royalty check if you write a toothpaste commercial.
Exactly. You know, and it's just, you know, as long as they get it right. And I really like the fact that people can get a hold of my knives that usually can't, you know, someone that couldn't afford a knife that expensive like myself.
Yep.
And especially with the Arcform and Custom Knife Factory, I mean, they did such a good job. I mean, it's literally like the same as my knife. It's really cool.
Is it better? That's a terrible question to ask. Yes. But
I mean, there's knife makers out there like Brian Nadeau that will make a knife that's like better than production quality. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying his production quality, but like,
well, because he's the machinist and he's in his own.
Like, they're making a ton of the same knife. He's making a small run that is perfected down to the most minute detail with these machines. Mm-hmm. These machines are made just for small batches, so they're insanely nice. They're actually better than these. But, you know, I don't have that kind of equipment. You know, so you know, every knife is different that I make. I mean, I try to keep them to a certain standard. Some are smoother than others. You know, some lock up better than others. But that's just with every knife I've ever handled, pretty much.
Well, that is the. I mean, I didn't mean that to be an obtuse question, but that's the beauty of something handmade is that each one is unique, and that nothing's going to leave your shop if it's not working right. Yeah. But right is going to be different for each knife. Yeah. You know, because each knife is its.
Yeah, and no matter what. How good the quality is of one of these mid-techs or production knives, they're never like, I could buy a couple different mid-techs here and there, but they're never as cool as having the actual custom. Like, and that's, that's for real, like not trying to be like stuck up. Like it doesn't have the same feeling at all. And even carrying like this Custom Knife Factory, it's gorgeous, but it's still, if I show it to somebody, you know, oh, this is my knife. I make knives. And I'd be like, oh, this is your knife. I'd be like, well, it was made in Russia, but it's exactly my knife, but yeah, it doesn't feel as cool.
It's like a body snatcher knife.
It does feel cool to say that there's people in other countries making my knives. Really cool,
because your designs are so sought
and
after.
The really cool thing is when China makes it without permission. That's my favorite. I absolutely love that.
Oh, dude. So you, I assume you're being 100% sarcastic.
No, actually, I absolutely love it, and because they're garbage and. The people that buy them are never going to buy my knives, so I don't really care. I find it to be like, it to be funny, man. I mean, if someone's like, you know, really dipping into your market, like I think Rad Knives had an issue with where they were putting out his knives and people actually thought
the cleaver, the big ass cleaver.
People thought they were his knives. And I think there was a couple of people that sold them for like his prices or something like that. I know it's like, I'm not 100% sure about what happened with him, but I know, you know, he was kind of newer to knife making. He got into it because he's an amazing machinist. And he's just like, I can do this, and just like blows everybody out of the water. And so I don't think he knew like exactly what was going to happen when he got that popular that fast. So I think he was a little bit like, what the hell? And, you know, I talked to him about it.
These knife guys are weird.
Yeah. What's up with these guys? But yeah, I mean, they made a Tanic with a Jason Stout blade. It was exactly a Tanic handle. Exactly to the last detail. And then his blade from like, I think a Blood and Thunder. It was the strangest thing I've ever seen in my life.
That's just creepy. It's like something out of a weird Japanese movie.
It looked good though. And I was like, hey, let's do a collab. And he was like, no,
leave me alone. You know, like, well, I have to say I'm getting my first custom knife in the next couple of weeks.
Oh yeah.
It's someone who's new to knife making that I interviewed recently, Douglas Esposito. He was at the Monkey Muster this year, and he does fixed blades, and they're beautiful, like little gentleman's assassin blades. I don't know how else to describe them, but when I was talking to him, I sort of told him what I thought the the best combination of his blade styles and materials were. And lo and behold, he has begun creating one for
me. Yeah, nice.
And I'm really looking forward to having a 100% custom knife and a handmade knife. And I'm actually afraid of what it's going to do to me once I have it in hand.
Well, that's pretty cool, man.
Yeah. I'm excited just to have something handmade. And I feel like that's kind of the way I'm heading. Do you think that this market for handmade and custom made knives, is this something that could have happened before now? I know it happened in small.
I mean, with the pricing being so crazy sometimes?
Well, it just seems like there are a lot of makers and there's a thriving market for knives in general.
Is it thriving?
And custom-made knives. It seems like it is from the buyers.
I don't know because I honestly, like, I don't know, like, what everything is doing in the knife community anymore, like, or what's popular or what's not. Like, some people say, like, oh, your knives are super hot right now. And I'm like, are they? Like, I'm not even I'm being serious. Like, I don't know these things. Yeah, I mean, all I do is work and hang out with my family. That's it. I mean, and right. I go on Instagram and, you know, people don't tell me things because, you know, I would love if someone said, hey, your knives are shit. You should do this with them instead. But people won't say that to me.
Everyone's like, yes, Jeff, your knives are so beautiful.
Yeah, a lot of times. You know, like sometimes I'll see people commenting and I never let the comments go to my head because there'll be like 30 that are all like, you're God or something like that. And I'm like, okay, thank you. Appreciate that. But then I'll go on another guy's. Y'all going like CMF and like the same guy saying you're God to him. And I'm like, yeah, I'm like, you can't let that stuff.
I pray to many gods. Yeah,
it's dangerous to ever let anything like that go to your head in any ways.
No, but there is something to be said for that endless scroll. And then coming across one of your knives, it's like, wow, that's unusual. I've never seen that's.
Well, apparently I broke the internet with my moon glow knife the other day.
Yeah, yeah. So what's with this new model?
It's 45,000 views on a video. That's really strange. Not normal for me. Wow. Yeah, 45,000 views at this point, and about 150,000 requests to buy it. Insane. Really? Like that's the most popular knife I've ever made in my entire career, I think. And I hated that knife while I was building it. I hated it the whole time.
Why? Because it was being a pain in the ass or because you didn't like the way
it looked?
I didn't
like the shape. And I actually changed the blade profile to a slight recurve, which actually made everything come together at the end. So very end, right before I hand rubbed it, I put that slight recurve and it kind of just worked. And then the hand rub made it so much better. And the moon glow was at the very end. I decided to put that in there. I was like, this is a material that is a joke to everyone for the last like 10 years. And I always thought it was kind of cool if you use it subtly. I put it on there and I'm like, I wonder what the hell people are going to say. And then I also thought to myself, there's a bunch of people that never saw Moonglow before because there's so many new collectors out there. And I get requests for it now all the time, all of a sudden, but the material's not really that great. I mean, it's.
Do you mean in terms of its its durability?
You ever see those little stars that kids put on their ceilings at night?
Same
stuff. It's plastic. So it'll break really.
It just cracks up in a couple.
So underneath the pivot, really slim and stout like that, it's not going to break. So I was okay with putting it there. Mm-hmm. The one in the spider hole there, who knows if it does break, I'll replace it, but it seems pretty sturdy.
So the spider hole, I want to talk about this new model for a second, but the spider hole, is that something licensed?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Every year I pay them $50 and you basically can just go wild with the spider hole as long as they're okay with it. You know what I mean? Like, you give some.
That's cool. I didn't know how that works.
They have to approve the model. I mean, I've never heard of anybody that wasn't, but I'm sure there's probably people that made some ugly, ugly shit, and they were just like, no.
Uglier than Spyderco.
Oh, boy. Dude, that was everybody in the beginning when they first started collecting. Spyderco is so ugly, and then I'm sitting there, like, just waiting outside with my pants down for my Spyderco to get to the mail. That was me, man. I mean,
it's the beauty of imperfection.
Are something, man. They're beautiful. They take chances. You know, you got to give them that. They take chances with some of the, some of those out there models, which I kind of like.
I was hanging on my phone for about a week and a half, like a 13-year-old girl, waiting for the announcement for the new M4 Jade Yojimbo 2, which is my favorite Spyderco model.
I have a couple of those. I don't understand that. Is that like a thing? Like everybody's like, I keep seeing the Jade Yojimbo, and I'm like,
No. It's just Blade HQ that when they do their exclusives with Spyderco, it's always M4 steel, and they use that natural.
Jade G10.
Natural G10.
Yeah, I did that way
and
back.
I've never had
I did that in the back of the day before them.
Well, I would.
I'm just kidding.
It took me a while to get cool. And so I finally got it. And it's really cool. And now I'm not even carrying or using it. And when I say use, my use is very low.
Why not? Jade's like, you can't make Jade look old or anything like that.
No. I don't know. You know, I'm waiting for a different clip. I have a clip on order that's going to come. I'm going to put that on. And I get nerdy like that.
Well, I would like to say something about a knife that I've been carrying and I'm absolutely excited about. It's the Joe Caswell CRKT.
Yes.
Provoke.
Yes.
I saw a picture of this thing. And I was like, that's weird. And I didn't have any interest in it. And then one day I'm just like, I could probably get the CRKT one from Blade HQ. And I did. And it is, this thing is amazing, man. I mean, I'm not trying to like toot another maker's horn, but I mean, this is insane.
So describe it. Describe what it is. And what problem it solves.
I mean, I don't know what the hell problem it solves. The problem it solves is I need something cool right now. And like, this is the coolest thing ever. It ticks all the boxes of like, just it's, you know, part like Mall Ninja. Cause you got a karambit that's like for fighting, but he advertises it as like, you know, for a lot of other things, law enforcement. And when I got it, I was like, okay, I see it. I mean, the thing is built like a tank and I've never owned a CRKT before. And this quality for $200 is unbelievable. I mean, I'm definitely going to get the mid.
They make good knives. I'm
going to get the mid-tech one if I can at some point. I already messaged.
The millet knives.
Yeah. I already messaged Joe Caswell and basically told him how amazing he was. And he was just like, thanks, dude. but I mean, it's exciting for me. I mean, I think it's exciting. It's a really cool design and it's really satisfying to open and close it. And then like on top of that, he's got a clip that's different too. That just, I mean, it's really cool. Right?
So for people who don't know this knife, it's a karambit. It's a folding karambit, but it can't fold onto your fingers. It has this
it's got like hinges.
Lever design.
You know what? It kind of reminds me of like, say you got like a robotic like spider or something like that. Like the legs, they kind of.
Oh yeah.
I honestly think he may have gotten an idea from that. Like, cause it the way it hinges. I mean, if anybody knows what this is, I mean, if you don't know what this is, you're probably like, what the hell is he talking about? But I mean, the way it snaps open and the way it locks, it's very different.
Yeah.
Very cool.
So, are you a better knife fighter now?
Oh yeah, yeah. I've taken out a few. Zombies here and there in the last couple weeks.
Well,
yeah. me and my Rick Grimes cult python.
you're a giant python. So who's buying your knives? I'm watching you every day on Instagram, and every day it's spoken for or sold. Who buys these gorgeous knives?
A lot of guys in Russia, which is pretty cool. I mean, there are a lot of really nice guys in Russia for some reason. I've always had a lot of customers out of Russia, and one guy in the Ukraine especially has been buying my knives a lot. But pretty much it's just first come, first serve. I mean, if I put up a work in progress and you say, hey, is this available? Usually it is. I don't do books because it's just, as a one-man show, it's very difficult to enter into a contract with somebody. And especially with my erratic design behavior, where I can't do a design for more than like a week, you know, doing the Tanix, I did have books and I took like 150 orders, and I, at like number 60 or 80 or something like that, I did not ever want to see a Tanix again. And, and I was just like, I can't, like, this is not fun for me. This is not what I wanted to do. This is a job now. This is boring. I'm not inspired. And it just,
You're making the donuts.
Yeah, now. It's just the same thing over and over. No matter how far I push myself to make something different, you know, they each had a specific idea of what they wanted, and they all wanted the same thing that everyone else had. And I luckily there was a good amount of people that were really cool about me just saying, like, listen, I'm not making these Tanix anymore. If you want a knife that I post, you're first in line. You know what I mean? So a lot of guys that came after that, like, hey, I was on the Tanix list, I check it. And, you know, they'd get top billing or top choice for whatever knife I made next. It was theirs.
So you actually clipped off the list before you finished it?
Dude, I knew that it would ruin me. I couldn't.
You had to. Yeah, no, I understand that. Yeah. Those people who came after that were better off getting whatever you were making at that
point. I think they were happier,
than some bitterly made Tanix. Yeah,
although the Tanix has a cult following still, man. I mean, I posted a picture of one that I got back for a repair. And people loved it. And I was just like, why? But yeah, it worked great. And it was smooth and everything. And it weighed a ton. I mean, it was a freaking boat anchor. But I get it. You know, I still think it's cool. But, you know, it's just, I'm not trying to be stuck up or anything like that.
So now, okay, you're talking about the Tanix. And it was an overbuilt boat anchor kind of tough, hard use knife. Now, what are your goals? What are your design goals?
Just sleek and nice, like smooth, sleek. And, you know, I like gentleman carry knives, but like, it's like a slight step up from a gentleman carry, like a little bit more rugged.
Step up in terms of utility.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as it, I mean, you know, like you have like a really nice, fancy looking, like art knife. You're never going to carry that and use it. So I don't go too detailed with the crazy inserts or anything like that. I wish I could, but I don't have the machinery still. But yeah, more of a sleek look, a sleek design. I always like the old school mixed with new school, like Isham did that. I can't remember the name of it.
The Pleroma. That's the one that you carry?
Yeah, that one too. But this guy.
Oh, the Black Star.
Yes. Yeah, this thing is like, it's like an old case knife mixed with like a tactical folder. And it's.
Yeah, that's a brilliant little. I haven't actually touched one, laid hands
it
on
is
one.
Tiny.
I would love to have a big Bowie knife with that blade.
Yeah, I almost was like, dude, I'm going to make one of these really big. Do you care if I make a flintlock one? Yeah. But I can't.
It's a beautiful blade. Yeah. And speaking of which, you recently posted this giant kind of, it almost looks like a proto cutlass thing that you're working on. It's a big giant knife. What's
Game
that
Game of Thrones
about?
Got to me, man. I mean, you know, like, dude, I'm a huge fan of like Hatcher knives and like,
oh God, this stuff is beautiful.
Dan Keffler and like, you know, those knives I always go back to in my head. And making a full fixed blade, like a big fixed blade, I haven't done it in a long time. And it's just a side project. I've been kind of tinkering with it after I work on my knives during the day, and I've been adding to it and taking away stuff. And yeah, just kind of a side project that I'm doing just for fun. And I got a guy that wants it. He likes to buy my odd, weird fixed blades all the time. So I'm like, you know, I don't know how it's going to turn out. So whatever.
Your fixed blades, which I don't know if you've been posting them more in the last year or so, or if I've only been paying more attention, but they're beautiful. For a while, you're doing these little, you're welcome, little steak knifey looking things. And then, but I mean, none of them look they all look like, I don't know, steak knives that you might see in the Game of Thrones.
Yeah, they're like really tiny, like skinny, kind of. Yeah, I mean, I have like three of them in the kitchen, actually. When I do keep knives. If you look at my knives in my kitchen, I have like six kitchen knives that I made. I don't think I've shown them really, but my wife loves them. That's you know, so I just make them out of whatever I have laying around, like scrap parts and stuff like that. I make nice kitchen knives out of them, and they're not great for kitchen knives. I mean, I don't make kitchen knives, so it's a different art form completely.
Right. So with Tough Knives as a company, where do you see yourself going? Are you going to go the route of Chris Reeve and Hinderer and Strider making custom things and having a small shop, or what do you have in mind for
Tough Knives? Was like the goal in the beginning. I think that was everybody's goal, to like be a Strider or Hinderer, where you basically have your models in three different sizes and then you got a production version of it. So you basically could sell a bunch of knives and then have fun just making your custom knives. You know what I mean? Like, and it's just, you know, that, but I don't know. I think it's, you know, I still would like to do that, but it doesn't seem like a thing that people really do much anymore. Like, you don't really see that ever happen because the mid-techs are here. And it kind of
you farm that stuff out.
Yeah, I mean, what they were doing was kind of like mid-techs, like made in the U.S. with their oversight. You know, like actually they're doing some work too, which is a little bit cooler than you know, some of these mid-techs. I mean, you know, they send them out. I mean, I don't know how they all do it, but like, you know, especially the guys in China, like Riyadh and all them. I mean, most makers aren't going over there and checking it out. You know what I mean?
Right. They're getting samples.
It's a bit of a hike, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, and there's companies like Millet and stuff where they do work closely with people. But yeah, I think it's different now. I think it's just, I don't know, honestly. I mean, maybe one day I'll team up with another maker and do something. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, that's always been kind of a thing in the back of my head. Like, maybe we could do some kind of project. Maybe me and Ian, like, he's right down the street from me. So
who's Ian?
CMF Knife Works.
Oh, yeah.
Knife Jesus.
Beautiful. Beautiful stuff. Wait, you kind of showed him the ropes, right?
He did. He worked with me in my shop for 6 months or so, and I mentored him and taught him how to do some things. And he took that and got taught a bunch of other things from other people. And now he's making more money than me. And they're gorgeous. I mean, I honestly feel like I don't know what the hell he did. Just one day, like, I saw his knives and I was like, they're cool. You know, they're like where they should be when you're starting out. And then one day, like, he made this model overnight, and it was like so much. It was like a 2 year period of evolution in my designs. He did like overnight. Like, he went from chunky big stuff to like these really sleek. And I'm like, wow, that's damn, dude. You know what I mean? Like, keep doing that, please. And he just does that, and they've gotten nicer and nicer. And of course, he uses all the premium materials, and I have no idea how he affords all that material, but it's freaking sweet.
I aspire to buy the custom knives that you make now. And when you get into that level of collecting, I would imagine you're not even concerned about carrying crazy exotic materials.
You know, I mean, dude, I freaking love OD Green, micarta.
Yes.
I mean, it's like, to me, it's more beautiful than Timascus. I know that's weird, but like Timascus is great. I absolutely love it. I will still use it forever because it's just amazing. But when you're just doing a Timascus scale, I'm not talking about Ian now. I mean, I'm just saying, like, yeah. You know, he does the pivot work, which is insane, and like all the crazy details. He makes it work really nicely. It's not just you're just run of the mill Timascus. But if you just do a Timascus scale, it's just a Timascus scale. I like to apply a Timascus in a different way or do something special with it. You know what I mean? And you know what you're getting with the Timascus, you know, depending on your finishes. And I like to go back to the more, you know, rugged look. You know what I mean? Like I like the just plain tie a lot of the time. And, you know, I really like a plain tie stonewash handle with a really nice Damascus blade. You know, that's kind of something I don't see very often, but like I love that contrast of like fancy blade with just working finish handle. But yeah, like I really wish people liked G10 because it's one of my favorite materials to work with, but nobody likes it. I mean, if I put it on a knife, it just drops the value. Nobody, really? I mean, people just don't want it, man. I mean,
what about how do people value micarta? I've been on a micarta kit getting a lot of custom scales.
Micarta is cheaper than G10 in a lot of cases. I mean, they're both pretty cheap materials, but I mean, and G10 is, you know, if you go back in my YouTube videos, you'll find a video of me and John Gray and Vance Rhodes torture testing G10 and carbon fiber. And in this video, I almost get shot by a crossbow from John Gray. We were a little drunk, but G10 held up better than carbon fiber and every other material besides like titanium. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, there's a classic look to my card, I think, that G10 doesn't have. It's kind of got that cold, sterile look.
Yes, yes. And there's also a grippiness to my card, warmth.
Yeah. When you sandblast G10, it brings out the grain to it, and I think it's just really nice.
Well, maybe you're the man to bring it back, you know? Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I'm working on C-Tech next, and maybe Cure Knight, but, you know, I'm kidding.
Kieranite. What's right.
I like Kieranite. It's good stuff, but yeah, C-Tech never worked out for me.
C-Tech, that's that hexagonal.
Yeah, it was interesting material, but you cannot put it on a folder.
I don't like the way it looks. It makes me grit my teeth. It's like tearing open a Nerf ball.
Yeah, you know? I can see what you're saying. Yeah.
Something about it grosses me out. So let me ask you one last question. And maybe this is not the question to end on, but if you had to criticize your knives or your knife designs, illustrate some way in which you want to evolve your designs, what would that be?
I mean, for me, it's design before everything else. And I'd like to kind of change that a little bit because sometimes I ignore some elements. Like a good friend of mine today actually messaged me because I knew what I was doing and I knew I did this. And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and lie and pretend that I didn't. But, you know, the blade was a little too wide for the handle. And it didn't stick out the back, but it was dangerously close. But I knew that if I had taken away any material from that blade, it would lose the look I was going for. And, you know, like, this isn't, like, something I do often. But sometimes, on rare occasions, I'm just like, I don't care. I want it to be this way.
And the aesthete.
Yeah. And I'm like, if there's an issue, I'll fix it. You know, I have no problem fixing it. But, you know, I've let stuff like that slide. I can't do that. You know what I mean? I have to make sure I don't do that ever because that was like a conscious choice, which was just a terrible idea.
But I mean, you made the conscious choice. You chose art over safety. And you know, that's something that a knife buyer might have to, you know, suck up and accept.
Yeah, but that's not a thing that I ever do. I mean, that's seriously, like, that was like a specific one that I was like aware.
Right.
And I even told him, because I talked to him all the time, I was like, yeah, be a little careful there reaching in your pocket. But, you know, and I was like, I even said, if there's an issue, just send it to me and I'll just grind it down there a little bit and, you know, it'll probably look fine. But I mean, I think the idea of the design first and function second, like, I think I would like to focus more on one model or two or three models because so the Prospect is taking over as one of the models I think I'll continue to make. The larger Prospect and the Mini Prospect. The Mini especially is, I think it's good. I think it's at a point where I like it and there's multiple different options for it to keep me satisfied for my creative wants and needs.
Yeah, and it seems like with the Prospect you have, you've been exercising a couple of options in blade shape. I mean, subtle differences.
Yeah, but like, very subtle. I mean, the slight, like, a slight recurve, like this one is the first one I did with like a slight harpoon. It's very Benchmade Onslaught or Bob Lum kind of looking.
Yeah, yeah. I guess I could see that. Yeah. Yeah, with the harpoon.
With this this G10, or this, not just G10, this carbon fiber, if we could see this here.
Ladies and gentlemen, tune into Tough Knives IG page to check this
out. It's got the Tough Knives logos all over it.
How did you do that?
I didn't. I had this stuff for about 10 years. I had the guy who made Blackslate carbon fiber back in the day. They're not around anymore. He made a bunch of that for me. And I used to put the glow powder in there and like glue epoxy. So it would, if you go away, I don't even know where the hell to find it, but I did it on a couple fixed blades. But yeah, I'm just using that material. I'm not actually going to keep those logos on there, but I thought it was kind of cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. I mean, I love that blade shape.
Yeah, I'm liking these ones. I made both of these knives that I posted today in record time. I don't usually do that, but I did two knives today, both functioning and round, which is really strange for me. I think it's because I bought that Python yesterday, which was really stupid of me to do. So I was like,
right, so you have to justify it with some good hard work.
Yeah, I got up at like 5 a.m. and I worked till about 5, and I got two knives almost finished, which is, I feel delirious right now. So if I'm a little weird on this podcast, I apologize.
So that's a perfect way to wrap up, Jeff. How can people find you, find your designs, find your knives, and connect with you to buy some of your beautiful handmade
usually
knives?
I'm at this bar down the street, just kind of hanging out, if you want to just go in there. Mostly Instagram for now, Tough Knives on Instagram. DMing me it usually works. And if you want one of my knives, best thing to do is like get them when I post a work in progress picture. That's usually when it's the easiest to get it. Yeah.
Reach out while it's still in progress.
Yeah, it's kind of a work in progress. I will not be going to Blade this year, unfortunately. Still trying to figure that out with my financial situation. It just seems like a very hard thing to do with the child and everything and all the bills. So, put my wife through college or classes to be a vet. So it's a little tough, but no biggie.
It'll pay off in the end. Well, Jeff Blauvelt, thank you so much for coming on the Knife Junkie podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's been a pleasure talking to you for the second time. Wish we were able to capture that first time, but hey, second time's a charm.
Or third, whichever. Been-
Great talking to you, sir.
You too.
Ever order a knife online and have it delivered to the office so your wife doesn't know? Chances are you're a knife junkie.
Welcome back to the Knife Junkie podcast, Bob. Just a good conversation there with Jeff. And again, thanks to him for being on the podcast again, even though our listeners will only have heard it for the first time.
Yeah.
But what was your thoughts? What was your main takeaway or thing that kind of struck you the most in this conversation?
He's just real salt of the earth, and he's proof that hard work and perseverance leads to some sort of legacy. I just think his work is starting to speak for itself, and he definitely expressed the frustrations of being a one-man shop, but also you can tell he's an artist who loves toiling, toiling in obscurity, if you will.
Maybe not some not so much obscurity.
Right. But he's alone in his shop, and he's turning out amazing work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Maybe one day, Bob.
Yes.
All right. Let's tease next week's episode. What can listeners look forward to next week?
Well, another sort of knife making outfit on that's in the vanguard, if you will, kind of changing things and making custom knives more accessible to the hoi polloi, such as myself. I'm going to be speaking with Chris and Elliot Williamson of Ferrum Forge next week, and they've just been. They've had a thriving custom career for about 10 years, but in the last couple of years, they've just been reaching a gigantic market with their collaborations with Mass Drop and Wii. And we're going to be talking about some of that stuff.
The knives keep on coming.
That's right.
That's how we roll on the Knife Junkie podcast. So for Bob, the Knife Junkie DeMarco, I'm Jim, the Knife Newbie Person. I want to thank you for listening to yet another episode of the Knife Junkie podcast. Look forward to seeing you back here again next week.
Thanks for listening to the Knife Junkie podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review at reviewthepodcast.com. For show notes for today's episode, additional resources, and to listen to past episodes, visit our website, theknifejunkie.com. You can also watch our latest videos on YouTube at theknifejunkie.com/YouTube. Check out some great knife photos on theknifejunkie.com/Instagram and join our Facebook group at theknifejunkie.com/Facebook. And if you have a question or comment, email them to bob@theknifejunkie.com or call our 24/7 listener line at 724-466-4487, and you may hear your comment or question answered on an upcoming episode of the Knife Junkie Podcast.